So we have had, I think, a very productive first part of the year with a very nice exposure to the main sugyas of Kinyan Kedushin. And while there's more to see, we didn't do everything, but we got a very nice chunk, I think, a very representational section of the major sugyas that address some different nuances, both the Ikarim of Kinyan Kedushin and the issues, the unusual situations, the cases that connected that sugya to other issues in Shas. And I think we got a nice perspective on that. So now we're going to switch focus greatly to another section of the first part of Kedushin, which is chock full of so much stuff and so many things that are both Shas relevant, but relevant also to halacha l'maisa, both lamdas and practicality of things that we experience on a more frequent basis than kedushin. So it's really a tremendous opportunity. I hope we have enough weeks left in the zman to really do it justice. Of course, everyone will be here for June too, so some of it may spill over into June. We'll see. But in any event, it's a very, very exciting opportunity. So essentially, what happens here, the starting from Daf Chavtes, we get into sugyas of Mila, major discussions about that. We get into sugyas of Pidgin HaBen, Talmud Torah, major discussions about that. And then, really, the main place in Shas where the halachas is the crucial, vital mitzvah of Kibbut Aveim are discussed. So that's a major, major theme. And then, following that, we get to the crucial section, which addresses the chiyuv and mitzvos of half of the population, the mitzvos of say shazman grama sugyas. Now, it's half the population, but it's not half the mitzvos. It's a very, very small section of the mitzvos that are really affected by the whole concept of mitzvos say shazman grama. But we'll talk about all that, God willing. Now, that is really towards the end. It's going to be mentioned right away in the Mishnah that we'll start with, but the details come up much later in the Gemara. So, in terms of the order of all the things that we spoke about, it's going to come towards the end, even though we'll see it mentioned right from the outset. So, this is a very exciting opportunity to really learn a lot of major issues in Jewish life in a thorough way and to really get exposed to a lot of things. So hopefully we'll take full advantage of it. But today, I want to just kind of introduce the topic by noting the framework in which it's in. And I think that's significant also. So the heading for all of these topics is, or at least the introduction to all these topics, is the concept of mitzvos ha'av ha'ben. So I don't know, mitzvos ha'ben ha'av. So let's, I don't know if you've had a chance, to see the Mishnah yet or not. So first, what I'd like to do is I'll read the Mishnah with you and the beginning of the Gemara, the first section of the Gemara, and then I want to discuss some framework questions that we're going to try to investigate and try to have in mind as we look at all the specific sugyas that come out of this. So the Mishnah tells us, kol mitzvos ha'ben al ha'av. Whatever that category means, we don't know yet what it is, but the mitzvahs of the child on the father, just a literal translation, whatever's in that category, anashim chayavim, v'nashim p'turis. Men yes, women no. V'chol ha-mitzvahs ha'ava la-ben, which is apparently the opposite of that, we'll have to discuss that too, echad anashim v'echad nashim chayavim. Men and women are obligated equally. V'chol mitzvah saseh shahazman grama, whatever that means, but roughly speaking, time-bound mitzvos, anashim chayavin, v'nashim keturis, men are obligated and women are potter. V'chol mitzvah saseh shalazman grama, any mitzvah that is not time-dependent, echad ha'anashim, v'echad ha'anashim chayavin, they're equally chayavin. V'chol mitzvah lo saseh, and prohibitions, bein shazman grama, bein shalom hazman grama, echad anashim, echad ha'anashim, v'echad ha'anashim. Whether it's men or women, everyone is chayv for equally. It's a prohibition, with a few exceptions. Chutz mi baltaki for baltashris, that refers to the prohibition of cutting off one's payas. That's baltakif. A baltashris here is used in a different context, in a different intent, and it's often used. Usually we refer to baltashris as the prohibition of wasting things. Here, baltashris refers to the prohibition of hashchasas ha-zokeh, of kind of cutting the beard and cutting it with a razor, as we understand it. So that's the reference here. Ubalt tamal amesim, and also the prohibition of being metame, which is a prohibition already limited to kohanim. But even with kohanim, it's only the male kohanim who are subject to this, and not the female kohanim. Okay, so far so good. Pretty straightforward Mishnah, but it contains multitudes. So before talking about it, let's just get a little bit into the Gemara, which the first Gemara, which is going to give us a little bit more detail. So you ask the Gemara, Michael Mitzvah Saben Alav. What does this mean, Mitzvah Saben Alav? What's that referring to? Ilema Kol Mitzvos Dimechayiv Bra. If you're saying whatever mitzvahs the child is obligated to do for the father, that nashim b'turis, so there you can tell me women are exempt. By Tanya, did we not learn ish ein li ela ish ish aminayim kishover ish imo v'aviv tiro harei kan shnayim? And then we talk about mora aveim, we see that they are both included. So if you're going to talk about obligations that go from the child to the parent, that's what we mean by mitzvahs ha-ben al-ha'av. So there's no distinction there. So Amar Rabbi Yehuda Hachiksani, Kol mitzvahs ha-ben ha-mutolos al-ha'av la'asos l'bno. Whatever mitzvahs the father has that he has to do for his son, there are mitzvahs regarding the child that are on the shoulders of the father to do for the child. Those mitzvos on nashim chayavin v'nashim peturis. Tanina l'halatana rabbanan ha'av chayiv b'no. We also learned that the father is obligated regarding his child, l'amulo, to give a bris mila, v'lifdoso, to do a pidgin ha'ben, if he's mature, u'lalamdo Torah, teach him Torah, u'lahasiyo isha, and to marry him off, u'lalamdo umnas, and to teach him a profession, v'yesh omrim, and there are those who add, af l'hasito b'mayim, also to teach him how to swim. And which is why Yeshiva University, in addition to teaching a trade, is makpid to have a swimming pool, because it's a full-service institution. So af l'hasito b'mayim, Rabbi Yehuda omer kol she'eino melamed is b'no umnis, whoever does not teach his son a trade, melamdo listus, he is teaching him he's teaching him to steal. He's teaching him thievery. Listus alkadaitach? What? Listus? Elak iwa mlamda listus. It's as if he teaches him mlamda, listus. Not mlambas. So here, it's just interesting in terms of the havmi and the maskana, because if you read this Gemara without Rashi, I think what you would think it means is that the statement is, if you don't teach your son a trade, you are teaching him thievery. And the Gemara says, really, thievery? That sounds pretty harsh. Really, that's what you're really apprenticing your child to join the mob? That seems like a pretty extreme thing to say. So no, we don't really mean that, but the Maisa, bottom line, that's what it is, because if he doesn't have a living, then he's going to end up stealing, so it's not like you're teaching him thievery, but you're bringing him to the point of thievery. That's how you'd probably read the Gemara by itself. Rashi has the question a little bit differently. Listus akadaita. Really? Bahalo yashav lo vindo kum. He didn't do nothing. He just sat and didn't teach him anything. So it sounds like what bothers Rashi is not so much the harshness of calling it thievery, but of calling it teaching. You didn't really teach him anything. You just kind of threw him to the wolves. So that's what resulted in him ending up in a life of crime. And the next Rosh says, the chayv de'ema umdus v'yechzul achmo yelech v'rosh hazrachim v'lastim v'sabrius, which that language is familiar also. You know it from Ben Sarumora. Right? That's what the language we find in that context, which is interesting also because there in that context, the whole point is it's supposed to be where it's the child's fault, not the parent's fault. But here we find the language emphasizing it's the parent's fault, that if you don't teach them a trade, so then that's what's going to happen. Okay, so essentially that little section of Gemara is helpful just to understand the Mishnah, really in the very basic sense, because the Mishnah doesn't tell you what it's talking about. So the Mishnah, as an introduction to the Gemaras that follow, really needs that first section of Gemara in order to have any substance to it. And then, after that, the Gemara starts going through one by one all of these things, and discussion of Mila, Pidgin of Ben, Talmud Torah, etc. So, God willing, we'll be able to look at all of those in more detail, starting with Bris Mila right off the bat, right after we get to introduce things a little bit. So, let's try to ask and figure out a few things about this Mishnah. I think there are a number of questions that could come to mind when you look at this Mishnah. Anyone have any thoughts? Anything you're curious about this Mishnah? Yes, Jebediah?
Why does this appear here?
Oh, all right, that's a great question. And, you know, this is the kind of question that Rishonim deal with all the time, right? The first Mishnah in Masechta, the first Mishnah in Perek, it's very often something that Rishonim talk about, and Achronim talk about, and you often have a lot of different answers. And I think it's important, these kind of questions, because not only do we want to understand the whole structure of Shas as much as we can, and to understand why the editor of the Mishnah has organized things the way he did it, but I think the answers to these questions are particularly interesting, because the answers that are suggested by Rishonim and others tells us what they think the Mishnah is really coming to say. And we know that there is organizational technique in Shas, Torah Shebaal Peh, especially because it had to be memorized, that things are clustered together. So if there is a din that relates to other dinim, so once you're talking about one, you bring in a few others. So it makes the question become relevant that if you have a Mishnah that says a number of things, which one is really what the Mishnah was coming to tell us primarily, and which halachos are there, because once we're talking about that, we'll mention all the others here as well. So the answers that the Rishonim give to this question becomes relevant to understanding what is the theme of this Mishnah, because we don't necessarily know. We look at the Mishnah by itself, it could be coming to tell us any one of a number of things, and then throwing in the other things while it's there. And asking this question of why is it here in the first place is a little bit of an entry point into what the main issue of the mission is. So what do you think the answer to the question is? Rishonim, again, have different suggestions. Achronim have a few extra suggestions. So what do you think the answer is? What in the world is this Mishnah doing here in the first parak of Kiddusha? Who's up first? He hesitates. Half a hand up. Sorry? That's it, guess so. So now you're asking the question through every cranny. Yeah?
Because one of the things that the father is supposed to do is marry
Shama. So who says that? The Ritva says that, right? So the Ritva says that this is ultimately here to teach us that the father has to marry off his child. Which is interesting. I mean, I guess that's why it's in Kiddushin, per se, as opposed to anywhere else. Why it's here, Dafke, after the Kinyanim, not sure, but it means that that's really the thrust, that this is basically here to tell us about the father's obligation of marrying off his child. That's it. That's what the Mishnah is here for. And once we're talking about that, let's talk about everything else. And everything else that emanates from that. Any other suggestions? Jonah?
Possibly taking us to the progression.
Okay.
Life, meaning one gets married and they have children and then there's mitzvahs
and all that. So here we're talking about what happens after Kiddusha.
Yeah.
You're saying that, so I actually think something along those lines, say it a little bit differently, but you're saying that this is a life cycle in the Sefta. So first we start with Kiddusha Right, has that poem used to say, first poem is love, which one's marriage, one's the baby carriage, whatever, something like that. Right, so now we're up to the baby carriage. So now we want to know, it's a whole book, it's both comes first or not, a whole different discussion. But without getting into that, but the question of the baby carriage, okay, so now we're dealing with the baby carriage. So that gets the bris milah. Okay. Any other suggestions? There are a few other things that are written in the Rishonim and the Achronim, and they are less guessable. They get more and more creative. So, for example, if you look at the Tosfos Rid comments on what we skipped. That basically, in the previous Mishnah, Chav Ches and Beis, talks about Rishus Gavoah and Rishus Hedget, about God's domain and about people's domain. So once you're talking about that, says the Tosfos Rid, okay, so now we got to talk about the differences between men and women. Not the kind of thing that we would guess first. But if that's... Sorry? Yeah, well, this Mishnah tells us women are chayavos in some things and not other things. So, but the point is, what's interesting, again, from that, is that it seems like that's what the Tosfos Rid, that's what I want to call your attention to, thinks that's what the Mishnah is about. The Mishnah is there primarily to tell us about differences between men and women. There are other suggestions in the Achronim, particularly if you look in the Pnei Yoshua and the Sefer HaMachneh that we mentioned a few times earlier in the year. So they assume that the focus is really something else. That the focus here is Kinyanim. That since the first part of the Masechta is talking about Kinyanim, and we spent a lot of time talking about whether it's a standard Kinyan or really something very different than all other Kinyanim, or is it something that just overlaps with Kinyanim? But either way, it helps us to focus on the concept of Kinyan. Sometimes Davka, when something is different than the rest, it helps us to focus on how the rest are understood, which parenthetically, for example, I think that's why Masechta Shabbos starts with Hotzah. Hotzah, which is an outlier in Malacha, and is identified as an outlier in Malacha by the Rishonim. So perhaps Davka, that's why it's helpful to start with Hotzah, because it allows us to discern what a Malacha is by looking at what breaks the rules. So even if we want to maintain, like we have, that a Kinyan Kiddushin is different than every other Kinyan, but it's certainly linked on some level, so it helps us to discern what Kinyan is about, when it's about pet purchases, when it's about Isha, when it's about other things. So here, the Pnei Yeshua and the Machna both suggest that this is about Kinyanim. The Pnei Yeshua, in a more straightforward fashion, he says, first we were talking about physical Kinyanim. Now we're talking about spiritual kinyan. So what's the ikar spiritual kinyan in life? Mitzvos. Right? That by performing mitzvos, so you acquire your chelek in Olam Haba, and the details of what's involved in Olam Haba. So therefore we want to list it, we want to take up the subject of the chi of mitzvos in general. That's really what this Mishnah is about. And if we're going to talk about kinyanim that come from mitzvot, so later on we'll learn here in Masechta Kiddushin the very fascinating little sugya of Gadol HaMitzuvah V'Yosa Mishena Mitzuvah V'Yosa, that there is a greater accomplishment, perhaps paradoxically, of one who is mechuyav in a mitzvah and one who isn't. So therefore, the Mishnah is telling us that right off the bat, because that's important to that topic. The Sefer HaMachneh has a more creative interpretation. It's a little bit hard to follow and to remember, so I'll just call your attention to it, that there is a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, in the end, in the sixth parak of Pirkei Avos, in the Bryson really, where it says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has five kinyanim in this world. Torah, and Yisrael, and Avram, and Shemayim Ba'aretz. So the Sefer HaMachneh has a creative way, the Beis HaMikdash, so the Sefer HaMachneh has a creative way of saying how the five chiyuvim of Aval HaBein, which again are only identified in the Gemara, But those five, and maybe six, if you count swimming separately, that is all there to parallel the kinyanim that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has. So Avram is Bris Milah, and Yisrael is Pidgin HaBen, because God redeemed them from Egypt, and he has creative ways in which the Beis HaMikdash is related to marriage, because that's the complete chasness between God and the Jewish people, and Shemayim V'aretz is where our Parnassah comes from, so therefore to teach an Umnus. It's a very creative suggestion that is interesting reading, but probably tells us a little bit less about what's the likely intent of the Mishnah. So, again, just to highlight, so let's, if we focus on the three explanations of the Ritva, the Tosfos Rid, and the Pnei Yeshua. The Pnei Yeshua, I think I mentioned, also quotes the same idea as the Ritva at the beginning, that is there because of the marriage obligation. But that gives us three different angles on what it means to what the Mishnah is trying to tell us. So according to the Ritva, the Mishnah is trying to tell us that now that we know about Kiddushin, we should know that the father has an obligation to marry off his child, and everything else comes from that. According to the Tosfos Rid, it's about telling us a distinction between males and females, and everything else is surrounding that. And according to the Pnei Yeshua's second approach, it's there to tell us something about kinyanim, and that once we have discussed physical kinyanim in the practical world, we now turn to kinyanim in the Olam Haba, and any distinction here between men and women is only to illustrate the issues of Gadol HaMitzvah v'Mishein HaMitzvah. Okay, so far so good? That makes sense? So I think also, I would say a little bit differently, I thought maybe John was getting at something along these lines, that I think we mentioned on day one, back in August, that there is a certain progression in Maseches Kiddushin, that, or really in Seder Nashim, rather. Seder Nashim leading up to Kiddushin at the end is all about issues of family and what family obligations are, what it means to be related. We start with that theme in Yevamos and go all the way down. So therefore, once we get to Kiddushin, so now we're actually creating the family unit. So first we're told about how the husband and wife become a family, how they become related to each other. That's what the first part of the paragraph was about, what creates Ishus. And once we have a related husband and wife, so now we're also interested in what it means to be related parentally, what it means to have a obligation that comes as a parent to a child. Okay, so what other questions could you ask? So now, having addressed somewhat Jed's question, so what else could you ask about what we've seen so far in the Mishnah? And these are not necessarily questions that we have to answer today, but I think questions that we want to keep in mind as we see some of these sugyas that might lead us an interesting path. Anything else you might be wondering about? Yes, Marty.
Gemara undoes the Mishnah's formulation of mitzvot haben
halacha. Okay.
So why was it formulated that way originally?
Okay. Okay, and definitely the question, the whole category of mitzvot haben halacha, that's something that we should try to understand in general. We should also mention that in terms of the Gemara and the Mishnah, the Yerushalmi has a different girsa in the Mishnah, which kind of incorporates the Gemara's back and forth. So maybe before next time we take a look at the way the Yerushalmi has this Mishnah, look at the commentaries on the Yerushalmi, you might see a little bit of insight into that. Jordan, is that a tentative?
Yeah, this is real.
Yeah, this is real.
So the Mishnah discusses mitzvah seishas and grav mitzvah seishalos. Those are polar opposites.
Okay. You say polar opposites then?
Polar
opposites.
Okay. Like one is positive duration, one is negative duration. However, for Avala ben Alav, those aren't necessarily opposite.
Well, that's actually something I'm curious about. I wonder, is there meant, not necessarily opposite, but I'm not even sure that Mitzvah Seisha is one grama and Mitzvah Seisha is one grama are really such opposites either. No offense.
They could be two sides of the same coin.
Okay, explain.
Meaning that there are, like, it's a it's like a 50, it's a zero-sum game split, meaning like if there's 60 of these kinds of mitzvahs and there are 40 of these, there are mitzvahs shezman grama and mitzvahs shelos grama. Let's say all assays can be categorized into one of the two.
Does that make them polar opposites? If I were to take all the words that have a B in them and all the words that don't have a B in them, so, you know, that would still create two absolute sets, but...
But I guess it's not, like, Aval and Vela are two completely different categories, so like, why are they being presented in the same vision as discussing a category of instance, I guess?
Okay, so let me tell you how where I was thinking about that, and you can tell me if this matches or different. So I think Mitzvah Seisha has Man Grama and Mitzvah Seisha Ein has Man Grama are not as polar opposites as one might say, because we don't know how important that detail is. So is it comparable to what I just said about words that have a B in them and words that don't have a B in them? And you know, maybe it's just one detail that we could say is either yes or no, but we don't know how central it is to defining a mitzvah. And it's going to be an interesting discussion to have. Is one the default and is one the exception? Which one is the standard? A mitzvah generally is man grama, is not man grama. What's the rule here? And what's the deviation from the rule? So that is going to require a lot more to try to understand that. But when it comes to mitzvahs ha'avah ha'ben, I think it's an interesting question to ask, especially the way the Gemara kind of sets it up. Is there some implied reciprocity there? Are they meant to somehow correlate to each other? We find that in Kiddushin, right? We find that there are obligations the husband has to his wife, and there are also obligations the wife has to the husband. Now, a lot of these are the Rabbanan, as I think we discussed at some point, so it's not clear how much we can build on that, but there is a certain mutuality in these family relationships. Is the Mishnah trying to convey to us that that's the point here also? That the child has obligations to the parent, and the parent has obligations to the child? So is the Gemara trying to tell us the relationship between, let's say, kibud av v'em and the father's obligation to give a bris to the child? So I think that's something to explore. On the surface, right away from the Mishnah, you can see a problem with that correlation. Now, what's the problem? Where's mom, right? So clearly, if she is a recipient of both kibud and mora, so if it's reciprocal, so then... how does that play out? Now, it could be, there might be an answer to that question, that maybe we have to tweak the reading a little bit, that maybe there is a basic reciprocity, but when this Mishnah says, kol mitzvos haben al ha'av, maybe it doesn't really mean kol, that maybe it means that there are certain specific ritual obligations, or more than ritual obligations, that fall on the father, which are singled out from the larger context of chinuch. That the parents together have an obligation to raise the child. And that's where this reciprocity kicks in. But there are certain bolate obligations which fall specifically on the father, and that's something that we have to figure out. And it's also noteworthy that the Mishnah is saying it as a klal. We'll see, it's not really a klal, because as you see the Gemaras, you'll see that each time the Gemara is going to give you a source why the mother is pater. Right, so for Smila, for example, the Gemara will tell us why the mother is pater from giving a breast to the child. And Talmud Torah, Pidgin Abed, in each case, there's going to be a separate source why that is. So it's an interesting language in the Mishnah to say kol mitzvos av laben or ben halav, whatever language we use, because it's not really kol. It's that there is a grouping which happens to focus specifically on the father, each one with its own unique source. But maybe that's to tell us that in general all the obligations of raising the child are on both, and there are certain tasks within that broad set where the father has a particular obligation. It's also interesting, as some sefer I was looking at pointed out, that there are halachos that are unique to the father and the child. Let's say, especially fathers and daughters, like being made for her to dara,
and Masa Yadela. And there we don't even ask how come the father and not the mother. We understand that there is a certain particular role the father has. And yet, with these, here the assumption is that really it should have been both parents. And these mitzvos are exceptions. So that's something also we need to figure out. What exactly is the statement here? Maybe this is all really reflective of a reciprocal relationship. And in Achanami, the mother is a huge part of that reciprocal relationship, with these exceptions. These mitzvos happen to be set aside for whatever reason they are set aside. So the notion of the mother being pater from these particular obligations, I think that's something we're also going to want to investigate. Is that something that is midin isha? Is that something midin parent? Is that something which is anomalous each time? So all of that, that's also going to require a little bit more explanation, and that's another thing that we can keep our eye out for as we get further into the Gemara. It also seems like the idea is that these mitzvos are really things that the child is really chayev on their own. And that really these are responsibilities the child has. But for reasons maybe practical, maybe overwhelmingly practical, let's say in the case of a 8-day-old baby, so the obligation transfers from the child to the parent, but really it's the child's obligation. And maybe that's what we mean, mitzvos ha-ben, al-ha'av, mitzvos that really are the child's obligation to do, but the parent is doing that because the child isn't able to either completely or fully. And that prompts a question that some of the Achronim talk about. So does it change once the child becomes a bar mitzvah? So let's say if you have the case of bris milah, so a child is unable to do the bris himself when he's 8 days old, but let's say he becomes bar mitzvah and it hasn't happened yet. So now, does the father maintain a chiyuv even after the child is 13? And one problem is also that if we're using godless as a cutoff, so what does it mean, for example, to say that the father is obligated to marry him off? Are these all viewed equally? Are we assuming that we're only talking about before the age of 13? And after that, there is no chiyuv? That would be a little hard to believe. Right, they used to ask the question in Europe somewhere that if you have an offer from a bar mitzvah and you only have one aliyah to give, who has the kedimus, the chasun of the bar mitzvah? And the answer came, whoever's older. So normally the assumption is the chasun is older. But is that the context here that we're saying that it's a toss-up and then once it becomes bar mitzvah, it's not a chiyuv of the parent anymore? So that's something we'll also have to figure out. And another thing, which I think is a very interesting question to consider, I don't know how much weight we can put on this, but if we're saying that this is about creating the family relationships, so the fact that mitzvah sasei shahazman grama is introduced in this context, is that a way of saying that mitzvah sasei shahazman grama is also about the family unit, as some understood? Right, we're not told directly by the Gemara why there is an exemption of the cessation of one drama. But there are those who have theorized, probably the most well-known theories, that it has to do with family obligations. Is that perhaps what the Mishnah is conveying by including it here in the context of other obligations of one family member to the other? Maybe. So I think those are some questions to keep in mind as we approach these Gemaras. Again, right after this, I'm going to say a few more points before going on. But let's say tomorrow's a Bechina, Wednesday we'll start new topics here. So assume that on Wednesday we'll start from Lamua. We'll start from the Bris Milah application. And that's going to, we'll take it from there. We'll get to a lot of these specific issues, but we'll try to keep in mind some of these questions to see how they play into each other. So just before doing that, let me mention maybe two nekudos to set the stage for that. So one, it's also interesting just in terms of the obligation to marry off the child, which, according to the Ritva, one answer of Lei Yehoshua, is the reason this mission is here in the first place. So there is an interesting statement of the Maharam Mintz. The Maharam Mintz writes that the second parak, the beginning of the second parak, we learn about the concept of Shlichus L'Kedushin. So the Maharam Mintz says that if you're going to use the Shliach L'Kedushin, once you're doing that, if you're going to get somebody else involved, the best Shliach to use is your father. Which is surprising, because you would have thought the opposite. It's not so b'chavadik to send your father on missions for you. You would not have thought he is the ideal choice. So the idea that he is the best choice is surprising. And Rav Yosef Engel, in the Gilyonei HaShas, to the beginning of the second parak, the Daf Mem Aleph, Rav Engel, quoting that Maharam Mintz, says that even though the Gemara says that when it comes to Kiddushin, better you should not use the Shliach, that Shliach is worse, but we don't recommend it. We say mitzvah bal yosim b'shlucho. We say that by all mitzvos, but especially by Kiddushin, we're afraid that it's not going to work out well. But, says Rav Yosef Engel, based on that Maharam Mintz, that maybe if one uses his father as a shliach l'kiddushin, we wouldn't even say mitzvah bo yosim b'shluchim. So that's interesting. And it's I don't want to get too much on a tangent, but just to illustrate what that may or may not mean. So I think there is room to be choker in the concept of mitzvah bo yosim b'shluchim. The idea that it's better for you to do a mitzvah yourself. So why do you have such a problem? Why is that true? So Rashi says on that Gemara that it's better to do a mitzvah yourself because, what'd you say? It's basically good advice. That since the fum sara agra, that the harder you work for anything, the more sara you're going to get. So when you have mitzvot that can be done through shlichus, so that's really kind of an easy way out. So you can just push a button and have somebody do a mission for you. Yeah, maybe technically you're yotze, but that's essentially a minimal star. And therefore, it's not great advice. So the best advice is to involve yourself as much as possible. So if that's the case, it shouldn't matter whether the shliach is your father or anyone else. It's still not such personal engagement in the situation. So, there is another mahalach here, maybe a few other mahalachim, but another mahalach is to say that essentially we say mitzvah bo yosim b'shlucho because it's a bizayon to the mitzvah that you farm it out, you delegate it out to somebody who's not really responsible. So if you have a personal obligation, and instead of doing it yourself, you have your secretary do it, have your secretary buy your wife an anniversary present, or whatever it is, so that tends to not display so much chashivas to what's going on, because the person who's responsible should be doing it. So if that's the case, maybe the chiddush here is that if you're going to just bring a random party in and have that person do your kiddushin for you, do your mitzvah for you, so that's embarrassing the mitzvah. That's delegating it to somebody who's not obligated. But if the person you're calling in really does have somewhat of a chiyuv, maybe it's not equal to yours, but they are a part of the team that is obligated, so then maybe that's not a bizayon to the mitzvah. So maybe essentially what they're saying is here we're told that the father has a responsibility, la'siyo'isha, so maybe that means that therefore he's a part of the team that's obligated, and to bring him in here is not to be delegating the mitzvah out and it's not the same kind of bizayah that might otherwise be associated. Okay, so far so good. Makes sense? All right, so now, to give you a point of transition, really within this, I just want to kind of introduce the milah topic. The topic in full we'll get into on Wednesday, but I want to call attention to a detail which specifically transitions this introduction into that specific topic. So the Gemara is going to talk about, just give you a little bit of a preview. So the Gemara is going to bring Psukim to teach us that women are not obligated to bris milah. Now, clearly not obligated bris milah for themselves, but they're not obligated bris milah for their sons either. And by the way, you should also take a look at the Meiri. Right? The Meiri, and we mentioned this before, the Meiri claims that these mitzvos that are listed here are all mitzvos that women are not obligated for themselves. And therefore, the point is that apparently we can't obligate them to do things for their sons that they are not personally obligated in. And that's why these are all exceptions. And I think within that Meiri, that could strengthen what we said before, that maybe the Iker is really the mitzvah ha'avim ben, really mothers are chayavos. It's just that these are exceptions, these are removed from the general category, because if there's an obligation that the mother would be chayavit for herself, so then we don't put that on her on behalf of her child. But the default is that parents do things for their children, and kibbutz avim is the reciprocal of that. So maybe especially with that statement in the Meiri, that could also highlight why these mitzvahs are different and why they create an exception to the category, but not really the definition of the category. But in any event, so the Gemara brings Psukim to tell us that women not only don't have to have a bris milah themselves, but they don't have an obligation on behalf of their sons either. So Tosus here asks a question. Tosus says, "Oh, so lo saw." It's quoting a line of the Gemara that we haven't seen yet, but we'll take my word for it. So it says Tosus, "Yim tomer lama likra." Why do I need a pasuk at all? Typically, the mitzvah says shazman gramahu. Why don't we say bris milah is a mitzvah says shazman gramahu? Shenimo b'shmini v'leidaso v'nashim peturos. Because the bris has to take place on the eighth day, and therefore women should be potter for that reason. V'yishlomar kevan demiyom hashmin v'hala ein b'hefsek lavs man gramahu. So basically, Tosa is apparently assuming that this man gramitude would come from the fact that it doesn't start until day eight, and that's a big deal. If you have a bris before day eight, it's no good. So therefore, let's call it as man gramah for that reason. So says Tosfos, no, but eventually it goes into full-time mode, so therefore, maybe that doesn't make it as man gramah. Then Tosfos goes on to ask, when Tomar Kasim says man gramah, with day man el biyom, k'dis par ka'ara. So what about that? So there's two ways we can call it Mr. Seisha as man gramah, that it has to be done after day eight, and that it can't be done during the nighttime, which is a big deal. That's why tefillin, basically, is considered to be a mitzvah seisha as my grandma, because we don't do it at night. So Yishlomar is a big finish, or the Asik, Manda Amar Hasim, the Mila Shul is Manda Heges, Bang Bayom, Bang Balayla. But maybe that's because of an opinion that we don't follow the halacha, that the same bris that's after the eighth day could be done at night. So that's why it's not a mitzvah seisha as my grandma, and that's why we have to answer it that way. It's very interesting on a lot of levels. And this is going to have all kinds of implications for Hilchos Milah that we will talk about more. But it's an interesting effort on the Mitzvah Seisha Hazman and Grama front. Now, Tosfos Maseches Pesachim asks, in Tzadi Aleph, asks a similar question. Why does the Gemara have a pasuk to tell us that women are keturos from Korban Pesach? Why do we call that a mitzvah seisha is man gram? And the Sfas Emes has an answer over there, which is really relevant to both of these. You could probably guess once we're grouping these two together. Right? What do you think the Sfas Emes' answer is? Why is it that Mila and Korban Pesach have special yimudim to tell us that women are butter? Why don't we say mitzvah seisha is man gram? So what do you think the answer to that might be? or any of that might be. So what do they have in common, those two mitzvahs, Karis, Pesach, and Milah? Dead?
They're both mitzvahs as a Karis.
Exactly. Right? They're the only two mitzvahs which we have an onish associated with them. The onish of Karis. So says the Sfas Emes, therefore you might have thought that they're treated like a mitzvah losaseh. That, in other words, we assume the distinction between aseis and losaseis are active versus passive. You do something or you abstain from something. But maybe here the distinction is chumrah or kula. That maybe there's a reason to say that all mitzvahs losaseh are more chumrah than all mitzvahs aseh. Because all mitzvahs losaseh, or most of them, have punishments associated, and we assume punishment reflects some level of severity. The worse the punishment, the greater the severity. And mitzvahs aseh don't have punishments. So therefore, one can make the case that as a group, they are all less chumrah than losaseh. But if that's the rule, so then maybe we should say, okay, but except these two, except for milah and Korban Pesach, which do have onshin associated with them, so maybe they should be treated like a mitzvah losaseh. And maybe for that reason, they get extra limudim to tell us when they're anyway. Now, you could use that to answer another question, by the way. Because there is a question a number of Svarim deal with, that we know that there are certain mitzvos that get suspended on Shabbos to Drabana. So we have a mitzvah to blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah, and a mitzvah to take a lulav on Sukkot, on the first day of Sukkot, the Muslim Torah. However, if these days fall out on Shabbos, so Chazal said, don't do it. That we're afraid you may come to carry, so we shouldn't do it. Everyone's always bothered with the question, how come we let a bris milah happen on Shabbos? Yes, we understand that's the din, that a bris on the eighth day should happen on Shabbos, but that was also true about shofar and lulav. So if Chazal prevented that, why did they also stop bris milah? So there are a number of answers that are suggested. I'm just going to mention the one that's relevant to what we just said. If you're interested in that topic, you know, talk to me later. But just focusing on one answer that connects to what we're just saying here, that you could say that the Gemara tells us in Yevamos that Chazal are only allowed to be Oger, or at least the Maskana of the Gemara is, Chazal can only uproot a mitzvah b'sheva al tasa, which sounds like it means positive mitzvahs. They can tell you not to blow shofar or not to take a lulav, but they can't tell you to violate a losa. They're not going to tell you to eat treif or to be makal shabbos. Right, so if you know those are the categories, they can say don't blow shofar or take lulav, but they can't say eat treif or be makal shabbos. So what distinguishes the two? Is it they can tell you to not do active things but not to violate averos? Or is it because of what we said before about chumrah and kula? That maybe there's just a limit, that they can tell you to skip mitzvahs aseh because they're not so chumrah. But they can't tell you to violate Navera because that is more chumrah. So if the issue is the second one, it's all about severity. So then maybe you should say that a mitzvahs aseh that has an omish, that belongs with the grouping of the los aseh. So maybe mitzvahs mila chazal can't be okay. Follow? That maybe even though it's a mitzvah sasei, we should categorize it as a lo sasei, and therefore say that Chazal can't tamper with it, and it takes place on Shabbos no matter what. That makes sense? And there are a number of other answers to that question, just mentioning that one because it's relevant to this tosis here. But here's a real segue point, and we'll end with this, and we'll just quickly review about Mincha. But there is a Chashuv Tosfos Rid on this, which, God willing, by Wednesday you will see. But the Tosfos Rid has a different approach. And this is a little bit of a clue to the concept of mitzvah Ha'avah L'Aveinu in general, as well as to the mitzvah of Milah. So that's why it's our traditional marker here. That the Tosfos Rid says that, no, this is not a mitzvah saseh shehazman gram. Why? Because you're assuming that it's a mitzvah saseh shehazman gram because the actual circumcision is constrained by time. It only happens from the eighth day on, and it only happens during the daytime. So yes, you'd be right if when we say mitzvah sa'ava la'vei ben alav, we would call it that the mitzvah is for the father to circumcise his child, then yes, I would agree with you that it's a mitzvah to say shazman gram. But that's not what our Mishnah is talking about. And what do you think the Tosfos Rid says? It's not that, what is it? What is the mitzvah saben alav the Mishnah is talking about? To make sure that it happens. So that means calling the moral and calling the caterer, going to the doctor, arranging for the food, arranging for the shul. So that's not Mr. Seisha's drama. That happens any time of day and night. So, therefore, says the Tosfos Rid, first of all, it's not Mr. Seisha's drama, and therefore we need an extra pasuk to exempt women. But also, perhaps more helpful here, it might be a clue into the whole mitzvah sa'ava la'ben idea. That we're not saying that the father actually has to do these things, but rather the father has to make sure that they happen, and that's the nature of what we're talking about here, and that may have implications for all of those things. Again, like we said before, the obligation of teaching you to swim, maybe he's mekayim that by sending you to a university that has a swimming pool. However you want to understand it, the university that teaches you a trade. So all of these questions are things that we will have to keep in mind as we consider these topics further. Especially we view what we highlighted here. So we saw a Mishnah which seems to come out of left field and doesn't have an obvious connection to the rest of the Masechta, the Parak. So we mentioned a few approaches in the Rishonim and Achronim, and we highlighted that we're interested in them because each one gives us a different focus as to what the Mishnah is really getting at. So the Ritva will understand the Mishnah is here to tell us about the obligation to marry off the child. The Tosfos Rid will understand the Mishnah is here to talk about the differences between men and women. And the Pnei Yeshua will tell us the Mishnah is here to focus now on spiritual kinyanim after learning about worldly kinyanim. And the mitzvah is the kinyan. And once we're talking about that, we have to talk about who's kaya or what. And we suggest a little differently that all of Masechta Kedushin is talking about what is necessary to actually form a family unit, and therefore we're interested in what these obligations are. So then we also try to figure out this concept of av ha-ben and ben ha-av, where we're told that there are five things or six things that the father is obligated to do for the child, and in the other direction, so there is kibud av-aim and mor av-aim. So we ask the question, are they reciprocal? Is it meant to convey that there's some connection between the two? And then that prompts the question, well, how does it work then if the mother is a recipient to keep it out of the name, but doesn't have it supposed to the other direction? And we suggested that maybe kol is really not what it sounds like. It's not all the mitzvahs of the child and the father. It's actually a list of exceptions. And that in general, the raising of the child is on both parents. And especially this works well with the comments of the Meiri on the Mishnah, that Meiri says that these items are all activities that the woman is not obligated to do for herself, and therefore can't be required to do on behalf of the child, but suggesting that the default is everything else, after you subtract these five things, those are obligations the mother has on the child, and that's essentially a reciprocal relationship. We also ask the question of, if we're talking about the family unit here specifically, does the inclusion of Mitzvah Seisha Zman Grama in this Mishnah tell us that that is also something about the family unit? And we also ask the question of, are these obligations the father has only when the child is a katan? Do they change when the child grows up? And if so, how does that affect things? Like, it's one thing to say that by new indigenous men. What about things like marriage, where we assume it's only true before bar mitzvah? It's very hard to imagine. So are we going to distinguish within the five things? So that's also something that we'll have to figure out. And then we referenced the Myra Mintz that says that if you're going to use the shliach, best to use your father because of this din over here. And Taravis Mengel says that it wouldn't even be subject to a criticism of mitzvah boyos b'shlucho. And we noted that if you understand mitzvah bo is about schar, it's not clear why that should make a difference. But if mitzvah bo is about it's a bizayin to a mitzvah to have it palmed off on somebody else who's not chayiv, so then perhaps we can understand it a little bit better. And we discussed also the Tosus here about the Mila Sukkah that we haven't seen yet. Tosus asks, why do we need to exempt women from Bris Mila? Why don't we say Mitzvah Seisha as Man Grama? Because of the timing. And Tosus says, well, in both cases, the timing falls apart after the eighth day, because at the eighth day, it can be any day. And Shalom Halachi says also it could be at night as well. And that we talked about another approach to this, Tzfas Emes, that this and Korban Pesach have the same question. And in both cases, you can say because there is a chumrah of an olesh, and we use that also to answer the question of why Chazal didn't make Xavier that we shouldn't do Bris Mila on Shabbos. And then finally, we know that Tosfos Rid as an important transitional marker between today's introduction to this whole Mitzvot Aval event issue and Bris Mila specifically, where we'll pick up on Wednesday. And the Tosfos Rid's approach is that no, it's not Mitzvah Seishas Ban Grama, because you're talking about the Mitzvah of Mila itself. That you could make a case is a Mitzvah Seishas Ban Grama. But here, we're talking about Mitzvah Saben Halaav. We're not talking about performing the circumcision. We're talking about an obligation to make sure that it happens. And that's something which could be relevant at any time of day or night. And therefore, that could have been a chiyuv on the mother also, and that's why we need a pasuk to tell us not that way. So that's an insight not only into issues of mila, but also into what it means to say mitzvahs are ben alav, and therefore that's a helpful transitional source, and God willing, we will pick up from there. All right, well, that's Menachem Yisrael in honor of my return to Chicago.